Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right. It is time for us to talk about the controversial hams that helped a French cathedral save its organ.
It's about time.
I know. It's the start of the year. We can put this off no longer. But Atlas Obscura has a beautiful write-up, including some images, which describe how in Saint-Flour, a town in the Auvergne region of central France, the highest cathedral in Europe perches at about 3,000 feet above sea level. Now, Saint-Pierre sits at the confluence of the dry winds that blow across the surrounding plateaus, which make it the ideal place to age local hams to perfection.
Oh, okay.
So how this all started, it was the brainchild of Philippe Boyer, who became the rector of Saint-Pierre in 2011. Soon thereafter, he encountered his first challenge. The 600-year-old cathedral was needing some TLC, specifically for its 19th century choir organ. It was in desperate need of repair. Mm. But the repairs would cost several thousand euros, which no one had, right? The diocese didn't have it. Mm-hmm. Certainly not the French state, even though the French state technically owns 87% of the country's cathedrals. But no, the money was not to be had. But Boyer was undeterred. Quote, I said to myself, why not make a product in the spirit of the great medieval abbeys who made their own food, which they sold to survive? So to begin, Boyer added beehives to the cathedral roof. And once the honey was starting to turn a bit of a profit, he turned his attention to one of the region's star products, Hambon d'Auvergne, a ham boasting a protected status, kind of like champagne or Roquefort cheese. Now, usually these hams age in drying rooms for about 8 to 12 months. But Boyer figured, hey, you know, we've got this North Tower that's not really being used. Maybe we could age the hams up here. So he mentioned the idea to a reporter from local newspaper La Montagne, and the article caught the attention of farm cooperative called Altitude. Their communications manager, Terry Bosso, said, we thought the idea was pretty original, pretty iconoclastic. Interesting choice of words. But he noted that this project could be the ideal way of promoting the work of their farmers and salaisonniers, the experts who cure and age charcuterie like sausages and hams.
Mm.
But of course, this being France, there was a whole bunch of bureaucratic hurdles they would have to clear, including authorizations from French health services, the certifying board granting the hams IGP status, and above all things, the architect des Bâtiments de France, a civil servant devoted to the protection of state-owned buildings. And according to Bosso, he gave his okay. So in June 2022, Bishop Didier Noblot officially invoked the protection of Saint Antoine in blessing the first hams. Now, today, the hams produced by one of Altitude's 30 farms are first aged in the cooperative's aging rooms. Only the very best are then selected for sale to the Association des Amis de la Cathédrale, whose volunteers meet weekly. Now, that's volunteers, so it's become like a real community thing, right? What they do is every week to replenish the supply, they carry these 10-kilo hams, which are about 22 pounds per ham, up the 150-something steps of the spiral staircase to the tower, where they swaddle them with bags and suspend them from hooks just underneath the bells of the cathedral. But, as all good things do, just after a few months, the project hit a snag. So, there was a new architect de Bâtiment de France, and he noticed grease stains on the floor beneath the hams, and, quote, he started to panic. Now, listen, the stains are easily explained by the fact that the bells are greased every 6 months. Mm. But remember in 2019, we had that whole Notre Dame catching fire situation? Well, so after that, the architect just was like, nope, I see grease. The hams are a fire hazard. Now, Boyer is quick to point out, quote, hams don't catch fire, just like that. But the group was nevertheless forced through another series of bureaucratic hoops. They had to adopt new protocols. At this point, the rector who started the whole program, he got transferred to another nearby location. So there was a new vicar of Saint-Pierre, Jean-Paul Roland, who received some news that the changes they made were insufficient and effective immediately. The hams had to be removed.
Uh-huh.
But Roland took advantage of the bureaucratic tangle. He decided that the diocese, as the renter of the space, was not responsible for what happened in the cathedral.
Okay.
So, you know, with the bureaucracy of who owns what, you know, we didn't have the money to pay for it. He's like, ooh, well, we don't actually have the authority to make any of the decisions.
Hey, listen, he's not wrong. I like it.
And it worked because he got the message across that basically, we're not taking the hams down. The hams remain.
Yeah.
So officially, the status is a bit convoluted. Officially, aging the hams is illegal, but the reality is they're still there. The locals love them. So for now, it seems this should be settled. The hams can continue to cure. And if you are in France or can get your hands on one of these sacred hams, it sounds awfully tasty.
Holy hams, Batman.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's a pun in there somewhere about like paying off pigs with a pig. Like somehow you're getting the cops off your back with pigs.
Off the back with bacon.
Oh, yeah. There you go. We just got to workshop it a little more.
Yeah. I personally, for some reason, feeling like that can be a slogan for my 2025, the ham remains.
Yes. Oh my God, I love it. That's what I'm saying to everybody from now on.
Yeah.
They're going to be like, what? And you're like, it doesn't matter.
Just trust me.
Roll with
it
me on this.
It speaks for itself.
All right. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from IEEE Spectrum, and it's a bit of a dense one, but I'm going to walk us through it. It's from the world of computer science, and it's titled, Reversible Computing Escapes the Lab in 2025.
Oh.
So, Michael Frank has spent his career in a very peculiar niche of computer engineering. In July 2024, he left his position as a senior engineering scientist at Sandia National Laboratories to join a startup US and UK-based Vair Computing. Frank argues that it's the right time to bring his life's work, called reversible computing, out of academia and into the real world because the computing industry is running out of energy. He says, "We keep getting closer and closer to the end of scaling energy efficiency in conventional chips. Reversible computing is one of just a small number of options for reinvigorating Moore's law or getting some additional improvements in energy efficiency." So, what is reversible computing? Intuitively, information may seem like an ephemeral, abstract concept, but in 1961, Rolf Landauer at IBM discovered a surprising fact. Erasing a bit of information in a computer necessarily costs energy, which is lost as heat. It occurred to Landauer that if you were to do computation without erasing any information, or, quote, reversibly, you could, at least theoretically, compute without using any energy at all. Landauer himself considered the idea impractical. If you were to store every input and intermediate computation result, you would quickly fill up memory with unnecessary data. But Landauer's successor, IBM's Charles Binet, discovered a workaround for this issue. Instead of just storing intermediate results in memory, you could reverse the computation, or decompute, once that result was no longer needed. This way, only the original inputs and final result need to be stored. So, they say they're going to give a simple example, which I'll read through, but I did not get it after just reading it. There were some gaps missing, but we'll go ahead. So, take a simple example, such as the exclusive OR XOR gate. That basically means if you have A and B together, and one of them is one, they will become one with C. But if both of them are zero or both of them are one, then C will be zero.
Yeah, it's a true or false on do they match or not.
Exactly, yeah. And so normally the gate is not reversible. There's two inputs and only one output. But the same computation can be done reversibly by adding an extra output, a copy of one of the original inputs. Now, the core idea here is that they can reverse the computation and reserve energy by not losing information. And this is where my brain broke a little bit, because I was like, wait, okay, how does that keep us from losing energy? You know, like, okay, great, you're storing more information.
Yeah.
And I would think that, you know, just doing the raw computation itself is what costs energy. And what Landauer's law actually says is that it is erasing a bit of information in a computer, which costs energy, because it's related to the second law of thermodynamics, or entropy, which is that in order to lose information, you have to compensate that as heat dissipation, which I don't understand how that works. Don't ask me to go that far down. It scares me. So the main way to reduce unnecessary heat generation in transistor use to operate them adiabatically is to ramp the control voltage slowly instead of jumping it up or down abruptly. The trick is that as long as you don't convert energy to heat but store most of it in the transistor itself, you can recover most of that energy during the decomputation step, where any no longer needed computation is reversed. And that, I believe, is where they get into where the information is stored. So it's actually stored in the transistor. And as long as you don't just throw that away, no heat gets dissipated.
Mm.
So Frank says that he feels most of the challenges will be in that custom manufacturing and integration to make these really efficient circuits. Because in principle, this allows us over the next 10 to 15 years to get 4,000x improvement in performance.
All right. Well, listen, I'll take that piece of information. I'm not assimilating any of the rest of it. But if you say it's going to be 4,000 times better, I'm like, cool. Okay.
Yep.
That's what I want to know.
Yeah, that's the key takeaway. It is quite technical, but what we're really getting at here is even by 2025 to 2027, you know, it may not be 4,000 times, but even 1.5 times would be a massive improvement if this were widespread.
Yeah.
It could solve energy issues with blockchain, with AI, with GPUs just in general. Mm. You might be able to finally have a cheap GPU that can run your favorite games or whatever. That's my personal concern.
But what if I like when my computer heats up my room so that I don't have to turn the heat on? Like,
it sounds like they've isolated or figured out how to manipulate the function of heat offset throughout this process, such that you might have a GPU that runs your favorite game, and then you could just switch it to lamp mode when you're done.
Yeah. That's what I want.
Right?
Or, you know, we can just keep all those historical massive towers that we have and just, you know, you just put it in the corner of your room and just have it run a media server or, I don't know.
Build a bookcase out of it. I mean, listen, don't let them go to waste. Build things.
Yeah. Next link.
Next link.
Speaking of energy, this comes from Popular Mechanics, the battery that will finally unlock massless energy storage. Okay,
ooh.
Bit of a misnomer. It's not really massless.
Always a lie. All right.
Yeah. Frictionless, massless.
In groundbreaking research, scientists have made a structural battery 10 times better than in any previous experiment. So it's a structural battery they call massless. So what does it mean to be a structural battery? The term refers to an energy storage device that can also bear weight as a part of structure. Like if the studs in your homes were all batteries, or if an electric fence also held up a wall. The main use for this is going to be for electric cars, where a literally massive amount of batteries take up a ton of room and don't contribute to the actual structure of the car at all.
Oh.
In fact, these cars must be specifically designed to carry the mass of all the batteries.
But if the car was a battery, just...
Correct.
All right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
To make the structural battery, the scientists layered a buffer glass, like a fabric between a positive and negative electrode, then packed it with a space-age polymer electrolyte and cured it in the oven. The battery's combined qualities, or multifunctionality, make it 10 times better than any previous massless battery, a project scientists have been working on since 2007. Chalmers University of Technology writes in a press release, quote, "The battery has an energy of 24 Wh/kg, which is watt hour per kilogram, meaning approximately 20% capacity compared to lithium ion batteries currently available." So not great, but 20% is better than nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But since the weight of the vehicles can be greatly reduced, less energy will be required to drive an electric car, and lower energy density will also result in increased safety. And with stiffness, a 25 GPA, which is gigapascals, the structural battery can really compete with many other commonly used construction materials. It seems that 25 GPA is about the strength of human bones.
Okay.
Just to give you some context for a future number that I'm
about right.
To
what we're going to be building things out of is human bones.
That's where it's at right now.
Right,
so the
right.
scientists say the next step, obviously, is to improve the performance even more, replacing aluminum foil in the electrode with carbon fiber material, because we all know how strong aluminum foil is.
Yeah.
But one of the most exciting that they mention is the use in aircraft, which scientists are struggling to turn into electric because the huge weight of batteries. Batteries still weigh way more than
right,
the
but
gasoline.
If the whole fuselage is the battery.
And then combine that structure with solar panels, and we could have a plane that just stays up there indefinitely.
Forever.
Unless it gets injured in some way. Oh, it got me right in the capacitor.
Right, right.
But also, and they don't really mention it, like if the buildings, if we could just build buildings out of this, that would solve a huge, huge problem that we have with solar and the like.
Mm.
So we're working our way there with structural batteries, probably 50 years off.
Right, right. We'll all try to live long enough to see them ourselves.
But then after that, we're good to go. We're good
Yay!
To go.
Uh-huh.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. This next one's a lot of fun. It's from bigclive.com, and it's called Inside a Crane Claw and How the Crane Plays You.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure these things are worldwide, but just in case there's some terminology differences, a crane claw is one of those big arcade machines where you maneuver a little grabby claw around to try to pull out a toy. And if you've ever played one, you obviously know how frustrating they can be, right? Like, have y'all ever actually wasted money on them, or are you like, never?
I've never won anything with it. Mm-mm.
But you have played.
Oh, yeah.
Certainly.
Yeah, we've all been compelled.
Right,
it's impossible
right, right.
not to be with the way it is.
Some of the things in there are cute, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes!
You gotta have them.
Look, an iPhone.
Yeah, yeah. So it turns out these things are actually a lot more complex than just having, like, weak grippers that always drop the toy you very clearly picked up. And I'm going to try to describe the mechanics as best I can, but if you want to see the whole thing taken apart, just go to the video. It's really great. And the guy's Scottish. He's hilarious. So the claws themselves are attached to a central pillar, and they're hinged in such a way that when the pillar is pulled up, the claws close, and when the pillar drops, they open. And when you look at one from the outside, you can see that that central pillar is going up inside a larger cylinder, which is the thing that's attached to the stretchy power cord. Now, inside that larger cylinder is a solenoid, which is a fancy word for a tightly wrapped spool of wire. And through the magic of electromagnetism, if you run a current through that coil of wire, you generate a magnetic field in the middle of the spool. Conveniently, the pillar attached to the claws is the perfect size and material to go right up the center of that spool. So the power goes on, the pillar is magnetically pulled upward, and the claws close. Power goes off, the pillar drops back down through plain old gravity. So, you know, it's pretty simple. Only it's not that simple, because the important thing to understand is that the amount of electricity determines the strength of the magnetic field. So it's not just on or off. You can 100% decide whether those claws are gripping that toy tightly or flopping around all loosey-goosey.
It's a choice. Mm.
It is. What's more, the owner of the machine can program it to deliver different amounts of electricity at different times. Specifically, they set a price point for whatever prizes are in the machine, and it will send weak electricity on every play until enough money has gone in. Then you get one grab with strong electricity before the cycle starts over. And you might think, like, why not just leave it weak all the time? But the thing is, they do want people to win sometimes so
That's
that you can
gambling
see
works.
That it. Yeah, exactly. So they basically are just like, all right, this is the amount of money I want per win. And that's how long you're going to wait before you make it possible to win. And you can actually see the difference in the grip strength if you know what you're looking for. I mean, the guy shows you, like, there's a little weak one, like, meh, and then there's a strong one. It's like, rah, cyborg arm going after the toy. Which means the way to beat these machines is to watch somebody else play and count how many weak grabs are in the cycle. Then if you're lucky, you can jump in right before you know a strong one is coming. But either way, the house always wins, and no one is getting a prize until the machine has been sufficiently paid for that prize. And this actually sort of destroyed a childhood memory that I have, because we used to go to this god-awful Pizza Hut buffet, and they had a claw machine, and my brother would try it. And there was one time, there was this older boy who was kind of watching my brother, and my brother kept failing and failing and failing. And then the kid goes, here, I can do it. I'll show you.
Oh, no.
And he immediately got the toy. And now I'm thinking back, going, he knew the strong one was coming.
His dad ran a bunch of those machines. He knew the secret.
Well, and he might have been paid by Pizza Hut for all I know, because then my brother was like, it is possible, and pumped a ton more quarters into that thing. So I'm very bitter about all of it. Don't ever play a claw machine.
So is there a way for us to 3D print an electrical circuit booster such that whenever, you know, it's a glove that we put on, so when we are connected to the machine, we're giving it strong grip.
Right. Time. We're just shocking it. I think it's probably easier to just break the glass if you're looking for light.
Shake the machine.
Yeah. Or, you know, get on Amazon and buy yourself a toy. You're an adult. You can do that.
I am. Maybe there's someone on GitHub who's got a nice Raspberry Pi solution to this.
Yeah, that's also possible. Next link?
Next link.
All right, we're going to go in a different direction with SciTech Daily, because they want to let us know what happens to your brain when you know you're being watched.
I mean, what if we always feel like we're being watched? Is that addressed?
Well, it kind of is. A psychological study has revealed that surveillance increases a person's subconscious awareness of being watched, which affects how the brain processes sensory information. Now, the study was small. They worked with 54 participants to examine the effects of surveillance on the ability to detect another person's gaze. Right, you can feel when someone's watching you.
Right, feeling, even if you can't see them, you know someone's there.
Yeah, so the lead author, Kylie Seymour, said previous research has established the effects on conscious behavior when people know they're being watched. But this new study provided the first direct evidence that being watched also has an involuntary response. In this case, the ability to consciously detect a face. Now, this is a pretty important characteristic because it's a mechanism that evolved for us to detect other agents and potential threats in our environments, right? Predators, other humans. Despite participants reporting little concern or preoccupation with being monitored, the surveilled participants became hyper aware of face stimuli almost a second faster than the control group. So they see hypersensitivity to eye gaze in mental health conditions like psychosis, social anxiety disorder, you know, where individuals hold irrational beliefs or preoccupations with the idea of being watched. Well, maybe we need to look at the word irrational.
I wonder too if it increases people's pareidolia.
Yeah. That's because there's whole social media accounts now dedicated to just like, look at this house that looks like a face and look at this faucet. And to what degree is that just us going, we know we're being watched all the time. Where are the faces?
Or it's just exploiting the fact that pattern connecting of recognizing faces is enhanced in us. And so it feels good when we have that problem to solve quickly. The takeaway that they came up with here was, whilst this investigation was specifically focused on unconscious social processes, future investigations should explore effects on the limbic system more broadly.
Or hide the cameras better. Like, just get better about not letting me know that you're watching.
So there's something I've noticed in the 20 years as an audio engineer with singers. In the past, it was absolutely no cameras while I have a singer in there. Because the question I used to ask was, if I've got a camera in the booth with you, are you thinking about how you sound or how you look? However, with 19 and 20 year olds who have lived their life on TikTok, they feel weird without the camera in there. Like, they have a harder time performing.
Wow.
So I'm not sure if age gap, right? They only did, you know, so many people. So,
right, in this study.
Right, is different from those of us that got it at, you know, age 20, 30.
Who remember privacy, who remember how to live in a world where you do things that are relatively secret.
Bring back secrets is what I'm hearing.
Yes.
All right, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from Live Science. It's titled Diagnostic Dilemma. A surgeon accidentally transplanted a tumor into his own hand.
Oh, accidentally? What?
Yeah.
There's so many things wrong with that sentence.
Oh, yeah. Man. You know, he was so hungover. He was just, last night was crazy.
Yeah, he gets home and he was like, oh, crap.
No, not again.
Yeah. No, it was a little more nuanced than that. So the patient was a 53-year-old man in Germany. And the symptoms for the surgeon were he developed a swelling in his left hand near the base of his middle finger, which was the site of an injury he sustained 5 months earlier while removing a patient's malignant abdominal tumor.
Oh.
During that prior operation on the abdominal tumor, the surgeon had nicked his palm. The wound was immediately cleaned and bandaged, but the appearance of an identical tumor in his hand months later suggested that the surgeon had accidentally transplanted cells from the patient's malignant growth into his body. Researchers collected samples of both tumors and conducted a genetic analysis. They found that the tumors not only had similar cellular compositions, but were also genetically identical.
Well, it's good to know that he wasn't doing the surgery with no gloves. Like, he nicked his hand with a scalpel and cut through the glove. Yeah. That makes me feel a lot better than he's just rooting around in there with hand wounds.
You know. Yeah, not nearly as bad as it sounds. I mean, still horrifying.
For the guy, yeah.
Yeah. At least he was in a place where he could access good medical care.
That's true.
So the surgeon's tumor was entirely removed via surgery. 2 years later, he was in good health, and there were no signs that the tumor had spread or returned. And although this accidental tumor transplant was highly unusual, sporadic cases of cancer being unintentionally transmitted through an organ transplant have been documented for decades, which researchers reported in 2013. So if you're ever in the same situation as a surgeon, you know, just double check that cut.
Oh, yeah, gosh. Put on two pairs of gloves, you know?
Yeah. It's... Next link.
Next link.
Okay, this comes from My Modern Met. After his death, Neil Armstrong's widow found a bag of space artifacts in his closet.
That doesn't surprise me. I mean, you know those guys are holding on to stuff.
There are many stories of historical treasures hiding for decades in attics and cupboards around the world, but few match what was found in the closet in 2012. After the death of Neil Armstrong, his widow, Carol, came across a white bag in a closet. And if you find a white bag in my closet after my death, please don't open it.
No, don't do that.
But she did. And upon closer inspection, she found tiny parts that looked like they could have belonged to a spaceship in an old picture of him and Stanley Kubrick on a set. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm just imagining this, like, well, we couldn't figure out where these bits go after we put it back together, so just hang on to them, like, you know.
The stuff turned out to be from the lunar module Eagle of the Apollo 11 mission. God. The astronaut's widow reached out to Alan Needle, an Apollo curator at the National Air and Space Museum, who had visited her a few weeks earlier to make an inventory of the items the Armstrong family intended to donate. He said, needless to say, for a curator of a collection of space artifacts, it's hard to imagine anything more exciting. I can imagine a few more exciting things. But the white bag, which made the trip to the moon, is known as a temporary storage bag, or, quote, the McDivitt purse. After the Apollo 9 astronaut who asked for a bag to put away objects when astronauts didn't have time to go through the fixed storage location.
Wow.
And then they
were just like,
go.
We're going to mock this guy forever.
Wow.
But actually, we all could use it. So we're going to.
Yeah. 100%. We all want a purse, but we're going to name it after that guy.
Uh-huh. So in the Armstrong purse, this is what was contained in it. The waist tether he used to support his feet during the only rest period he got on the moon, equipment netting, a mirror made of metal, an emergency wrench, an optical sight that was mounted above Armstrong's window, and most importantly, the 16-millimeter data acquisition camera that recorded the footage of the lander's final approach.
Wow.
That last one's, pretty big.
He stripped that thing. He took a lot of core pieces.
Okay. All of these were bound for the same fate, though. They were going to be destroyed when the Eagle crashed into the lunar surface after serving its purpose.
Oh, okay.
Since the crew had to account for any added weight, Armstrong didn't just steal the bag. He didn't sneak it. Mm-hmm. Mission transcripts record Armstrong telling Command Module that they had it.
And he took a few souvenirs. Mm-hmm.
Later, the bag would be described to Mission Control as, quote, odds and ends and 10 pounds of miscellaneous equipment. While it's unclear how Armstrong retained possession after the mission, he's not the only astronaut to have kept such mementos.
Surely not.
It was so common that in 2012, President Obama signed a bill into law granting NASA's Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo crew members full ownership rights to their space artifacts.
Amnesty. Yeah.
Wow.
Today, the data acquisition camera is on display at the National Air and Space Museum after Armstrong's widow donated it in 2019 alongside its power cable. Other items are listed as, quote, promised gifts. So I guess she'll get them there eventually. Mm-hmm. The author noted that it's neat that he saved all these items. However, for me, like, he kept them all in his closet.
Yeah, he didn't let anybody see him. I mean, I get there's a thing of like, you're the only one who's done this at this point, and you want to hold on to some mementos. But also, it wasn't like he put them in a nice little display case. He shoved them in a bag in a closet.
Yeah. So. I mean, who's to say that they weren't deeply cursed and he was trying to protect the world from a fate of interacting with them, which we have very soundly overturned.
Yeah, it would have been better if he let him crash on the moon in that case.
Just left him there.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include YouTuber Legal Eagle is suing over PayPal's honey extension, dogs and owners' hearts sink during interactions, and scientists have grown part of a human spine in a lab. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/daminteristingweek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Weisberg Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.